You're listening to the Embrace Family Recovery Podcast, a place for real conversations with people who love someone with the disease of addiction. Now here is your host, Margaret Swift Thompson.
Welcome back. In this final episode with Casey Arriaga, we discussed navigating the ups and downs of recovery within a couple and a family. Casey shares his personal journey of becoming a counselor and an author, and we dive into sustaining a long-term relationship throughout the disease of addiction and recovery. Let's rejoin Casey.
The Embrace Family Recovery Podcast.
You must have been a lot of fun to be married to for 34 years because you strike me as a person, A, highly intelligent, fascinated to learn, always want to be continuing to educate yourself. And I'm imagining that there are times where you do stop and you are able to not be in that place. But is that true? Do you find yourself going there? Like you appear to be very kind of like that 10-year-old boy who was determined to do something different. Like, I was going to learn. I was going to be engaged. I was going to start the social. It feels like that's still true in you, that you just have this curiosity for human capacity and human nature and always want to learn.
I will happily claim all of that. And believe me, there have been plenty of ups and downs and times where we thought we were not going to make it. But my wife, 34 years in, would still say that I'm fun to be married to. And vice versa. We share our sense of humor, which is one of those big factors to say whether or not people are going to make it. And I know for a fact my sense of humor does not click for everybody. I'm still amazed sometimes when I will tell a joke and she laughs. I'm like, do you seriously think that's funny? Because I know almost all my colleagues would just go, oh, God, Casey, it's a terrible joke. She thinks it's funny. And she swears it's for real. But yes, well, the thing is, my wife is also really brilliant. Yeah. She also loves to learn. So we have those things in common. I am a higher energy than average person, so I'm a higher energy person than she is in general. So sometimes I'm kind of that motor driving. But I think sort of part of the question in there is like, yes, I do stop and relax. It's not go, go, go all the time. But and it's not, again, driven by fear as much as it used to be. I'm sure there's still some in there. It'll never be 100% gone. But as my first therapist, Lee, would say, the buttons get smaller and harder to push. So over time, this comes from more of a relaxed place, but I find it's still who I am. Yes, I love to learn. I love to teach. And my first sponsor, we still talk. I wouldn't say he's my sponsor at this point, but we've been talking for over 20 years. And so he's seen me through the whole arc of it. He saw, you know, he knew me when I was just brand new sober. He saw me make the decision to go to school, let alone go all the way through and get my master's. He's been, you know, watched all of it. He went to my graduation for my master's degree. I graduated out in Boston and I'm living in Texas. My family's in California. He said, hey, Casey, so, you know, any of your family going to the graduation? I said, my wife's flying out. We're going to fly out to Boston for the graduation. And he said, I'll meet you there. He went to school in Boston. So he and my wife were the two people that went to my graduation for my master's degree at 48 years old.
Awesome.
In all of that, he would say, Casey, you can watch, you're going to have three phases to your career. There's going to be the phase where you're just learning what you're doing. There's going to be the phase where you do it a whole bunch and you learn things, you develop ways of doing things. And then there's a phase of your career where you teach others and you show them what it is that you learned and you pass the torch to the next generation. And I looked around one day and said, wow, that happened. That's where the impulse to write books, have a podcast. At my workplace, I supervise people who are master's students, and I supervise people who just got their master's as they're moving towards being clinical social workers. And I love all that stuff. My mom would tell you from a little kid, I love to teach. I now have something that I can speak about that I can teach. I'm going to teach it. I love it.
You would be incredible to spend time with to learn from. It was a compliment and not a question even. It just amazes me when I meet people who are on fire through so much turmoil. What I think sets you on fire, and maybe, you know, push back if I'm wrong, is the healing that you've been able to do, that you just want other people to find their way through and out and in a different place. So like to be able to share from a place of, wow, what a difference my life is. Thanks to my recovery, my mental health care, my things I did, there's hope there for everybody. I want more people to know.
Absolutely. Yeah. Once I got the hang of therapy with Lee, I initially just thought everybody needs to go see Lee. I would just tell my friend, really, they talk about something and I go like, there's a solution to that. Go see Lee. Now I can say like, here's how to find a great therapist. Here's how to find a good recovery meeting. Here's some good books you can read. It's nice to have more resources, which is the most social worky thing ever.
But it's true. We have come a long way. I mean, there was many more stretches to make and many more things to do. But to have access, even just all the meetings you listed for sex and love addicts, and to know the history of it, because it's not something I'm familiar with. You know, my tunnel's been pretty minimal around substances. Yes, there's overlap. I don't dispute that at all. But then my own recovery with food was like a major eye-opener because I didn't think there was such a thing, right? So it is nice to have you on to put voice to, and thankfully you're willing to do that, a type of addiction that many people don't know about, are scared to ask about, don't even know where to begin with. So it's a huge blessing to have someone on who's willing to talk openly about it and maybe offer a path for someone who's finding themselves struggling.
That would be amazing. So yes, if there's anyone listening or watching this and think like, maybe that's me, let me just tell you, there's so much hope and help available. Mm-hmm. And what I found is as I healed and let go of my own shame around it, mm-hmm. it seemed like it was easier for other people to talk about it as well. Like it just makes it easier. Whereas I think if I was going, oh yeah, sexual addiction, and couldn't even say it out loud, then I think other people to a certain extent take some social cues from that. Not everybody, but some will take cues from that and go like, oh yeah, there must be something wrong with that. So I think it's important. It's very real, but it's important to be able to say like, hey, I can have my head held up high. This is my life. This is what it's looked like. It helps to be in recovery from it versus in the middle of it. That's a lot harder to talk about. But even then, I see people all the time who talk openly about like, I am struggling with this. I don't know where to start. It's beautiful to be able to say, there are so many answers and so much hope. And I didn't have to have invented it. I am simply passing along what was freely given to me.
That's right. How beautiful is it? Because you think about relationships, take away recovery, take away family of origin. Think about relationships. Where else? Like, this is when I wish more people had recovery, because we are gifted something that I think is very unique to us. And that is a sponsor who we've known for 20 years who goes to your graduation in Boston. Somebody you've talked to about the ins, the outs, the ups, the downs, the darks, the lights, who's taken time with you over those 20 years, who knows how many hours, right? That's pretty remarkable. Not many of us have that unless we find ourselves in some sort of recovery community with a tribe of people who get what we're experiencing.
Well, that's absolutely true. And it highlights that so many of the things that I felt like I had to do when I got in recovery are now the same things that I get to do. Mm-hmm. I get to talk to a sponsor. I used to have to talk to a sponsor. Oh, I have to go to meetings. Now I get to go to meetings.
It's true.
I get to do all of these things. And I feel bad for the average person on the street where when they run into some major struggles, like they don't know who to turn to. Or as so many of us do, like they may turn to a family member or something like that, which I'm so glad when people have family support. But a lot of times your family hasn't been through it and they can't say like, oh, I went through that. It's okay. Here's how I got through it. So yeah, tip of the hat there. I put a children's book out and that kind of took over the book I was in the middle of writing. Thank you. I was writing a completely different book that I'm still working on called The Gift of Addiction, which is about what a gift it turns out to be when we go through this kind of crisis and the ways that we grow. And I'm interviewing people and putting their stories into the book about the recognition of, I would never have learned any of these things. Like if I hadn't had the addiction, then I would never have grown in these ways and I wouldn't feel this inspired. And I can say the same thing. If I hadn't been through the struggles, even as a kid, that flash of insight at 10 years old wouldn't have happened. Or if it had, I'd just been like, oh yeah, whatever. And I probably would have gone on with my day and had a sandwich. Mm. Like I wouldn't be inspired to live a life of growth mm-hmm. if there hadn't been pain driving it initially. But what's beautiful is that over time, the pain goes away, but the growth does not.
And the drive for growth doesn't.
Yeah, the drive for growth has never gone anywhere. There's never been any point where it goes, okay, So again, maybe that's that part of me says, get as much as you can, as fast as you can, except it's just all really good, healthy stuff. I don't know. Maybe. Either way, it's working out pretty well.
It is. I think it's wonderful. And I think it's very hopeful for people who are listening who may not have ever ventured into a room where the 12 steps or another recovery community offers them. I know for me, the stunning awareness was sitting in one of my early meetings, having come from family and a history of people when I did share something, it was, here's how you fix it or don't talk about it again, that I sat in that room and these women who I'd never met, never seen before, didn't give me a solution, didn't tell me what to do, showed me kindness and unconditional positive regard, as I call it, and shared themselves, even if I wasn't. It was like walking into what I assume it might feel like to land on a different planet, because it was so atypical to what I knew and experienced. And yet such a prevalent gift that I still hold dear, that I was greeted with people who shared, did not tell me what to do. When I asked what they did, were willing to share more and just held space for me to show up and learn on my own timeline. It was an incredible life-shifting experience. And I value that to this day. And I think that's why podcasts are so appealing to me, because I know people are out there, they can get little nuggets at the pace they want if they're starting to venture into this learning and exploring possibilities around addiction as a disease for themselves or as a family member's disease. I think it's quite remarkable to be able to go and listen without having to worry about sharing or having answers or being told what to do.
This podcast is made possible by listeners like you.
I hear from clients all the time, I feel so alone. No one understands. Why can't they stop? Don't they love me? I understand this as I felt it to my core when I was in a relationship with an ex-partner who had an addiction. I did not know what I didn't know. And I felt so isolated, ostracized, fearful to share, to be judged, or have him mistreated and judged. I was very much in protective mode of him and thought that I was helping him. I didn't help him. And actually, I was hurting myself as I tried to fix, manage, and control a chronic, progressive, and potentially fatal illness alone. If you can relate to this feeling, to this experience, please do not keep doing it alone. I can support you and educate you about this complex disease, and we together can co-create a path forward to peace and a strong recovery foundation for you. Reach out to me at embracefamilyrecovery.com, where you'll find a Work with Margaret page, and we can set up a complimentary conversation to see if we're a good fit to move forward.
You're listening to the Embrace Family Recovery Podcast. Can you relate to what you're hearing? Never miss a show by hitting the subscribe button. Now back to the show.
Recovery is a gift. I love that. I look forward to your book. I think it's so true. I remember thinking when I landed beat up and bruised by my ex's, he called it sexual compulsion. I remember feeling A, I would never love nor trust again. B, I am more damaged than I already was. C, something is fundamentally wrong with me that he did this in our relationship. I must have done something wrong. I must have not been enough. You know, all the stuff that goes along with the being the partner of. And then I would have never thought or dreamed that I would get to a point where I would say, I can't say I'm grateful I went through that, but I can say I believe that that led me to a solution that I probably wouldn't have found without it. And I'm grateful for that. So as you look at your 34-year relationship, which is wonderful, congratulations. I really commend you both. It would seem that one of the things that has helped you maintain commitment and work on yourselves is the fact that you both have been avidly seeking, healing, growing, learning, leaning in versus leaning out, communication. A lot of the humor, the things that you talked about have helped you sustain and have a long-standing relationship.
Absolutely. Well, and it goes back to, that was my original filter, was I'm only dating people who are willing to work on themselves and work on the relationship. And I recommend that to anyone that will listen, especially if you're on a growth path.
Right.
What's beautiful is I said that one time, and I don't remember if I was talking to someone in one of the rooms in recovery, I think I was talking to a client, therapy client, and they just talked about the insight they saw through it in a way that I hadn't. They said, you know, that quality embodies so many other qualities. Because if you're willing to work on yourself, then you have to have some measure of humility, some measure of insight, some measure of courage, some level of self-compassion. There's so many other qualities that I would find positive in a human being, let alone a partner, that are embodied in the simple willingness to work on yourself and work on things in the relationship. But it also gives you something that you can get through. And or like a set of tools to get through things. I have like said that to people, and they go, "Oh yeah, well, I'm dating someone. I mean, they watch their diet, they work out all the time." I'm like, "That's great, but that's not what I'm talking about."
Right.
When I say work on yourself, I mean specifically. No offense to anyone, not even spiritually, not physically, but psychologically. Mm-hmm. Being willing to look at your own thinking patterns and think about how you think, and being willing to work on what you find, however grudgingly. I mean, you know, look, I'm not gonna like hype myself up here. I mean, many, many ways that I've grown, I went in kicking and screaming and fighting it. And as people have said before me in some of the rooms of recovery, everything I've let go of has scratch marks in it. You know, these were not things where I got up one day and said, oh, I'm going to change myself, and then everything changed. This is a long, slow, at times painful process. Plenty of things where I say, like, I don't need to work on that. And then circle back and I'm like, okay, let me look at it. And having that compassion and patience for myself, which is very much demonstrated by my wife, and then being able to offer that in return for her, which I've also not done perfectly. There's been times with either of us where we get impatient with each other. Will you work on this forever? Or did you work on that thing in therapy? We don't really say that anymore, but early days, we would be like,
probably not a great thing to say to each other if we're working on stuff. The thing with that though, do you think, and this is, I don't know, maybe going down a different path, but it struck me listening to you. Do you think that the way that I would describe it is when you're in recovery as a partner, right? You're going down this path and sometimes you're ahead, sometimes you're behind, sometimes you're off to the left or the right. Mm-hmm. But ultimately, you have all these tools around you that bring you back together in a healthier way if you utilize them. So like the asset of a sponsor, the asset of a philosophy of living through the 12 steps or smart recovery, whatever your path is, the spiritual growth, the emotional growth, the therapeutic value of seeing a therapist as a couple individually when things arise. How do people grow in relationships and sustain relationships without that?
Well, everyone's got their own path. I'm going to say sometimes luck, sometimes they don't. Maybe they are more patient than I am and just be like, I would have run to people like, oh, he's just a grump. It's kind of like, well, yes, I would agree from what the little I've seen. I can only imagine when he first wakes up in the morning. it's kind of like, okay, well, maybe, a high tolerance for a difference. And, sometimes it doesn't last. You know, a lot of marriages don't last. A lot of relationships don't make it. And again, there have been times where I was not sure our relationship was going to make it. But sometimes there are abandonment issues that kept us together. Like, we were unhappy or unsettled or feeling threatened by each other. And yet, we really didn't want to be without each other. And, I was 20 when we got together. She was 22. We have grown up together in most senses, seen each other go through an awful lot of change. But on the balance, shaking it all out, it's all positive change in the aggregate of things. You know, it's like a lot of those sort of stock charts where it's, up and down and up and down. But over time, if I look at where are we today, we've also both said, with just absolute truth that if age difference is notwithstanding, but if I met 22-year-old her, or she met 20-year-old me today, just where we're at emotionally, each of us be like, oh, honey, oh, no, we're not doing that.
I think they're gifts. I think those tools that we are gifted in our recovery, if we utilize them in our relationships, whether it be our partners, whether it be our parents, whether our children, what gifts they bring to the quality of all those relationships if we use them.
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, we talk about 12-step programs, but all 12-step programs also incorporate 12 traditions. And the traditions are things that talk about how am I in relationship with others. And even though we're talking specifically, most literally about how to conduct a recovery group, they are also talking about how to relate to others. You know, yeah. Am I putting the common welfare first in this decision? Am I in some way, shape, or form self-supporting through my own contributions? Or am I looking not just financially, but am I looking for my partner to carry all the emotional weight? Or am I actually sustaining myself and contributing?
Right.
Is a loving higher power the ultimate authority in the relationship? Things like that. Those are big things that we can pull out of the 12 traditions that can very much be incorporated into a relationship.
So you got into writing at some point on this process of teaching and giving away what you've been giving and sharing. You got into writing. What was the first book you wrote?
The first book I wrote was one called Realistic Hope, the Family Survival Guide for Facing Alcoholism and Other Addictions. And when I was near the tail end of my master's social work program, I remember saying to my wife, you know, when this is all done, I'm probably going to write a book. I just always felt like I should write a book. Now, my adoptive dad was a writer, and mm-hmm. he wrote public relations and stuff like that. But he always wanted me to be a writer, and he very much raised me to be a writer. And I had to recognize at one point that if I write by hand, I have to be conscious that my shoulder doesn't go up and my hand doesn't tense up, because I'm waiting for him, even though he's been dead 25 years, I'm still waiting for him to pop up and look over my shoulder and say, you spelled that wrong.
Wow.
So he was loving but tough and critical. I tell people he would probably be very proud that I write books now. He'd probably be horrified at what I write about. Because sure. In my books, like in this interview, it's all out there. So yeah. It's like, you know, here's his drinking problem. Here's the sexual abuse. Here is my own stuff, the sex and love addiction. It's all in there. But it's all in the context of how can you help your family survive addiction? And what are some of the tools? And so that was, I wasn't sure what I was going to write about. I still have a book title that I've never used. So someday I may get around to finally writing the book I thought I was going to write. But we were in the shower one morning. I just went, oh, of course. I've been running these family workshops for, you know, at that point, around 10 years or so. And I thought, I did the math on that. And I thought, okay, I do one every weekend, but we go on vacation a couple weeks a year. So let's say 50 a year. At the time I started writing, probably 450 family workshops, you know, thousands of people had come through them. And I thought, that's what I need to be writing about. And I'm going to say this part, and it always sounds like it should come out of ego. It doesn't feel like it comes out of ego. This is just the honest feedback I've gotten is, you know, I think when I was very early in doing family workshops, because you're right, I'm passionate about helping families specifically. And that is, again, one of those things. It's like, you know, you go through med school and you may decide that you're going to be a hand surgeon, but you find that you're brilliant at heart surgery. And at some point you go like, okay, I guess heart surgery is my thing. Mm-hmm. Or pediatrics or whatever. Mm-hmm. For me, it was family work. As I was just learning how to be a counselor, I got thrown into doing the family workshop, and I just found I love this. And I seem to talk about it in a way that families can understand and wrap their heads around. And so it's helpful. And somebody said, man, when are you going to write a book?
Yep.
And meantime, I'm like working on my associate's degree. I was like, oh, yeah. Right. And he goes, no, I'm serious. You should write a book. And so 10 years later, kind of fulfilling that promise and request. I've had people say, hey, the way you conduct the workshop or the way you talk about these things, I've been to a bunch of these with other people. They're shaming the families. They're telling people why it's like, you know, it's mom's fault or whatever. Or they're telling the families like, hey, if you play your cards right, you can basically manipulate your loved one into recovery. Like, stop enabling, stop giving them money, just do this, tough love, that, all this kind of stuff, and they'll be sober. It's like, that's not true. That's why I call it realistic hope. Sometimes we give families completely false hope, this illusion of control. So I had gotten enough feedback of like, you're saying this in a different way that is easy to understand. I thought, that's got to be the book that I write. And I never thought I'd write a second book, just like, this is going to be, there'll be my book. So I wrote a book, and I published the book. And on the day that I finished it, the title to the next book popped in my head, which is Spirituality for People Who Hate Spirituality. And I thought, I've worked with a lot of people, particularly around 12-step recovery, who struggle with the spiritual part. And I thought, sure. I struggled with the spiritual part. So if I put part of my story in there, plus all the conversations I've had, the tools I've learned, and then I did a bunch of research. So if you look in the back of my books, outside of the children's book, big reference section. If you want to go look up the study that I read, there it is. There's lots of them. because I wanted to make sure I was saying something that was at least had some factual basis to the best of what we know today. Yep. So that was the second book. And then as soon as I finished the second book, like literally finished the artwork on it, and the title for The Gift of Diction popped in my head. So that's a great title. What am I going to write about? So that launched that one. And then partway through, so that one's still about, you know, a third of the way written at most, because partway through I'm part of a writer's marketing group, and somebody said, hey, kids' books are really hot. And I just thought, like, okay, that's just like some marketing thing someone puts out there, like just write a children's book, whatever. But here's where my sense of humor is a little dark. I said, oh, like, what am I going to write? A book called Mommy Drinks Too Much? Come on. But by the time I drove home from the marketing meeting, I thought, no, I need to write a book called Mommy's Getting Sober. Like, what do we tell all these kids who have a parent in treatment or early recovery? Thank you. There's the plug. what do we tell them? And so I went home, and that night I wrote the first draft. In the morning, I got up, polished it a little, and then set about finding an illustrator. I was really fortunate to find Sky Hilton, who just has a beautiful sort of magical realism and childlike wonder in her writing. And as she's been open about, and she did an interview on my podcast, talking about her own personal connection to the work. Because I wanted to, you know, you can hire lots of artists, but I wanted to find somebody who really got the material. And frankly, there's a lot of artists that have been through some of this stuff where I thought, like, okay, I can find somebody. And there was Sky, recommended by a friend. So she did that one. And then the beautiful irony of the whole thing is people said, well, you should write more children's books. I thought, what am I going to write? Same question. Well, the perhaps higher power answer to that one is actually the next book is in fact going to be called Mommy Drinks Too Much. Because it occurred to me, there's a lot of kids whose moms don't get sober or haven't gotten sober yet. And what are we telling them?
Right.
So she's already got the preliminary sketches done for that one. The text is done. So, and then we're going to write, we'll make it a trilogy. The third book will be about talking to kids about once their parent is in longer term recovery, how does this child frame it and find their own recovery? What does that look like? So the working title on that is Mommy's in Recovery and So Am I. And so it will end up being a trilogy, and that makes me happy. And then one of these days I will finish The Gift of Diction. So yeah, that's how I went through my journey of Bookhead. I guess, what would I say? Higher power keeps throwing ideas at me, and I keep saying, okay, thank you. I'm going to put it on the list. We will get that one
right away. Get to it. Yes. I think that there is no irony or coincidence that you do have a passion for family, because your journey started as the child of. Yeah. And though you've had your own journey as a partner of, your own addiction, your own recovery, as a parent of someone struggling with mental health issues, you know, it's pretty wonderful that you have the gift of being able to see both sides of the journey so acutely well that you can offer through your writing some of your experience, some of what you witnessed, some of what you've heard, some of what you've learned. This book is fabulous. I love anything that gives children understanding and information to not be in that place you were at where nobody talked about it, but your few year older brother. I do wonder if it's okay to ask, did your father ever find recovery?
He did in his own way. I didn't find this out till he had been dead about 20 years. And how I found out was I was at my mom's house, and my mom does not throw things away. She has check registers from the 1970s. So I'm looking through her pantry and I'm trying to find, I think she said, oh, I might have that tea or snack or whatever. Just kind of look through the cupboard. So I look through the cupboard, and back behind all these things are about, I don't know, 15, 20 bottles of liquor with a thick coating of dust on them. It's all my dad's old liquors in there. And people would give these things to him as gifts because he was a high-ranking, you know, professional in his field. And so they wanted to win his favor, and they knew what he liked. So he had all this alcohol. And I was like, Mom, you still kept all of Dad's bottle of alcohol. She goes, oh, yeah, no, it's still in there. I said, would it be okay if we got rid of this? So I got to live out my childhood dream of pouring all my dad's liquor down the drain. Oh my God, the smell.
How wonderful.
But I got to do that.
like a full circle moment, right? Like, even though he wasn't there and it wasn't at him or about him, it was for you.
It was cool. But that led to a conversation with my mom, who, again, is not super open about all this stuff, but became more open over time. And I like to think that's partly because of the influence of recovery, because I was becoming more open with her. And I was able to ask in straightforward, like, Mom, I would like to know more about your life. You know, we only have so much time on earth. I want to know you better. And she kind of brushed that off initially. And then she kind of came around to it and started talking more openly. And so one of the things she told me is that my dad actually sobered up the last 2 years of his life. No program, no meetings, no help. So I got to actually ask. Because I know there's, you know, a good percentage of people that just, you know, get sober on their own. They just stop. I said, what was that like for him? She goes, oh, he was miserable. Because he had to kind of fire all his friends. He stopped talking to people. He didn't develop a bunch of new friends. And he didn't have that social support that you get from recovery fellowships. So he just did it as he had done so many things on sheer determination, anger, and willpower. And it worked for him. I mean, he quit smoking the same way. He just stopped one day. And it was apparently the same thing. The first time it was because, ironically enough, when he was drunk, he fell down, broke his arm on Thanksgiving. And as they were doing the surgery on the arm, they found an aneurysm right up the middle that was going to kill him, which, by the way, those things are exacerbated by drinking alcohol. So his compulsive drinking probably made that worse. But his compulsive drinking also saved his life, because without falling down, he would have just fallen over one day, probably at his desk, or God forbid, on the LA freeways. So I believe he quit drinking when he got a cancer diagnosis, and he just stopped. But did he find recovery? Not in the sense that I think of it. He found sobriety, and I'm glad for him. I mean, that's still better than going out, you know, the way many people who are drinking go out.
Right.
And I would like to think that they gave him a chance to be more real and present with my mom, and they loved each other a lot. And he was very protective of her. But unfortunately, as is often the case in those dynamics, he would be able to protect her from everyone but himself. And so my hope is that that allowed him to do a better job of that part. That's my hope. But unfortunately, my mom, she's still alive, but she's at an age where those conversations are gone. And so I'll never know. I'll never really know what that was like for him. She has referenced how hard it was for her when he was drinking. So my hope is that it was easier once he stopped for both of them.
I think you're a blessing to your mother. I mean, yes, challenging, I'm sure, if she's not one to talk. Yeah. But what a blessing to have a son who has worked so hard on himself and healing from. And bring it, you know, being willing to be open about it, even though it can be uncomfortable when you come from a family where we don't talk openly and we don't talk feelings and we don't do that. Like, I imagine that would have been, you know, you said earlier, my dad would probably be proud I'm writing, but maybe not about what I'm writing about. I like to think he'd be proud of it all, because maybe you're doing things he didn't have the courage to do.
That is always possible. He was often proud of my accomplishments, even when he didn't understand them. And he was a very smart man. I don't mean like intellectually, but like emotionally. I made a lot of decisions where he just would think, why are you doing this? And a lot of times he was right. Like, why was I? I couldn't tell you. A lot of them were not great decisions, but some of them were, you know. And he would usually kind of come around. So I don't have a strong spiritual opinion about what happens after people die. But if he is aware on some level of what I'm doing, then I'm sure that he's very happy with it.
How's your brother?
Anxious. He's, he is somebody where I'm going to say also has opened up more over time. I feel for him. I used to be very jealous of him. He was the one who kind of did all the things right, you know, got out of high school, went right to a great school, graduated in 4 years. He's one of the top performers in the country in his field, you know, and he has no idea what to do with it. He's just kind of like, yeah, I guess. I mean, he is the true loyal son. He's the one who is a gift to my mom, because when COVID happened, he still lived back in the Los Angeles area, and he just moved into her house, and not in like a moochy kid, wouldn't let me in a there to protect my mom and make sure she survived kind of way. And he has been her prime caretaker. He does all the heavy lifting in that. I'm the guy who moved halfway across the country and writes a note card once a week. And I'm happy to be able to do that. But I will say that just a few weeks ago, I was able to have a conversation with him when we were talking about, you know, we're getting older. You know, he's 2 years older than I am. And while neither one of us is, you know, likely to fall off a health cliff anytime soon, it's always possible. But to the best of my knowledge, he has some friends, but he doesn't have anybody. I don't think he's built a strong relationship with himself, let alone other people. I know he has friends who are good friends. I don't know any of their names. He's very, very private. But I was able to say to him that you're not alone in this, and that I know I was not a good brother, but I'm in a different place now, and I've grown a lot. And I am with you in this. We are with you in this. You are not going to have to go through this alone. And that means a lot to me to be able to say that and to mean it. And, you know, we'll see what it actually looks like as it goes along. We'll probably all be leaning on my daughter. Who knows? She's a very straightforward person. We've even had conversations where she said, yeah, my life expectancy is probably a little bit lower than average for most people my age. So she goes, we'll see who lives longest. But, you know, she and I have made up some funny t-shirts that she can put on me if she puts me in a rest home.
Somehow I don't disbelieve that. I believe that to be very true. I think it's really interesting. We have some similarities in our parent, in our age. My brother's 2 years older. My brother was straight A student, went off to college. I was the problem child who was seeking anybody to make me feel better. And I was not a good sister, nor was I aware of what I had done or not done as a sister. So I can relate to a lot of what you're sharing. And isn't it wonderful and shocking when we engage in our own recovery and we go back to our families of origin who may not be in recovery, and how much things change because, wow, I was contributing that much to the problem. Ooh, is that one of those humbling experiences that I am also grateful for, because I'm a big fan of recovery. I'm a big fan of taking our own inventory, keeping our side of the street clean, growing and working and showing up differently for the people we love once we have the capacity to do so. It's pretty amazing.
Well, this is also speaks to that idea of the gift of recovery, is that I started out in my family, you know, at many points along the way, if you looked at the family constellation through most lenses of society, I was the one who was the farthest behind. And now I'm, by anything that I'm interested in measuring, I'm out front. I mean, my brother probably makes more money than I do. It's not the kind of thing he'd ever discuss. I just sort of assume he does, but I do just fine. But emotionally, I'm in a place that none of my family members are anywhere near. And it comes out of starting from so far behind that, again, I was the one who was inspired to start working on myself out of sheer desperation and unhappiness with how things were going. But then I couldn't find any reason to stop. And so I just kind of kept going. And I tell a lot of my clients that. I'm like, your family may be here and you're down here, but if you're going like this, you know, when you get here, you don't have to stop. You're probably just going to keep on going and shooting past those kids in high school who are voted most likely to succeed, et cetera.
Right.
And you get to live this life. Not have to. You get to.
And in recovery, we have choices we get to make, which we didn't have when we were in the depths of our diseases. It was a lot harder to have those choices be possible for us. As Casey shared in episode 146, my higher power can take any character defect I have and put it to good use. I'm so grateful Casey chose to share through his podcasts, books, videos, and the family program at Windmill Wellness Ranch. Inspiration, resilience, and growth are descriptions I would use to describe Casey Arriaga. Keep doing all you do to help the still suffering. Come back next week when I have the privilege of introducing you to Jacqueline Brown, who chose to leave corporate America to pursue her passion of reducing stigma surrounding substance use disorder and drug use, empowering others to tell their stories and changing the conversation around addiction and mental health after tragically losing her brother to substance-related issues.
I want to thank my guest for their courage and vulnerability in sharing parts of their story. Please find resources on my website, embracefamilyrecovery.com. This is Margaret Swift Thompson. Until next time, please take care of you.